New Orleans. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. For nearly 40 years, Bruce Rayburn curated one of the nation's most treasured jazz archives and was based here in New Orleans. Much of his work pieced together the origins of the jazz story, beginning with the city's earliest unrecorded ensembles. He then followed the music into the next two centuries. But that's not where Rayburn started in jazz. His father was a big band leader with a soft spot for bebop, and his mother could have been a contender.
You know, they're getting back on the band bus and they're arguing about who did more for each other's career. And she definitely wanted to lead that band.
Bruce Rayburn tells how his story fits within the story of jazz after the break. Bruce Rayburn grew up in the 1950s and 60s watching American Bandstand on television and loving rock and roll. He's a drummer in rock bands and punk bands. He even played with New Orleans R&B greats Earl King and James Booker. But what makes Rayburn's light shine so brightly in music is that for nearly 40 years, he was the curator of the William Ransom Hogan Jazz Archive at Tulane University. Perhaps no living scholar knows more about the earliest practitioners of jazz in these parts, or the New Orleans style of play. For instance, Rayburn would know that this is none other than Freddie Keppard playing cornet on a 1926 recording of Brown Sugar. Rayburn would also know that to some minds, Joe King Oliver eclipsed Keppard on cornet. And when Oliver got to Chicago, he called for a young Louis Armstrong, who soon eclipsed him. The rest, of course, is in the archive. Rayburn has made the oral histories of hundreds of pioneers of jazz accessible to music lovers everywhere. And many serious students of jazz have benefited from Rayburn's expertise. Earlier this year, Rayburn retired. He's settling down in Spokane, Washington. But we talked to him at the archive on Tulane's campus in a Music Inside Out exit interview. Apparently, Rayburn was swaddled in jazz from the beginning.
My father, Boyd Rayburn, was a big band leader, and my mother, Virginia Powell, better known as Ginny Powell, was a vocalist, jazz vocalist. She worked with Boyd as soon as she got out of high school and fell in love with him.
So Boyd Rayburn and his orchestra in the 1930s, though, were seen as sort of a dance outfit, right?
Not adventurous at all. Leonard Feather called them a Mickey Mouse band a la Freddie Martin. Which, by the way, was very popular in the 1930s. If you wanted to make money, that was a good approach.
But very damning from somebody like Leonard Feather, who was, you know, not only a musician, but also a very powerful critic.
He was using contrast, because what happened with the band from about 1940 on is this sort of chrysalis effect, where they emerged into a magnet for young bebop artists who were looking for some freedom and of expression. And trying like the new thing based on what Bird and Dizzy and all of that coalesced around Boyd, and to some extent, he just sort of rode that wave. It wasn't a wave he created. His arrangers were the ones that became the architects of the sound, but they were extremely gifted and adventurous. And so by 1944-45, he was considered to have one of the most interesting big bands incorporating bebop in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a hard sell because it was extremely progressive, and some people were calling it avant-garde music that was hard to dance to, which in the mid-1940s could be a liability. The critics loved it, but the general public didn't always buy into it.
Interesting, because the purpose of a big band, and particularly within the eyes, I would imagine, of the band leader, is essentially to stay afloat. Because it's like a traveling circus in a way. You know what I mean? You've got to. It's oftentimes a big and unruly group of people with lots of divergent interests. And all.
You just nailed it. That's a great analogy, because that's what Boyd was up against, is trying to sell a band that the critics loved and the public was not so sure about. You know, hard to dance to was the thing they kept hearing. And they're about making art. They see jazz as an art form. They're trying to really break new ground artistically. And that's what all his arrangers were about. That's why he attracted so much young talent to the band. But your analogy of a circus is extremely apropos, because within that band, very talented individuals, but there was a clique of heroin abusers, there was a clique of alcoholics, there was a clique of marijuana users, and then maybe another category just for strangeness in terms of the behavior of some of these people. And Boyd had to ride herd on all of that. And
Right. I mean, my understanding is that, you know, this band featured people like Roy Eldridge, for instance, at a certain point, like Trummy Young, you know, who was the great trombonist who I think played with Armstrong.
He
Louis
did.
Armstrong,
he was in
right?
the All-Stars.
Right.
And he'd come out of the Lunsford band. Trummy was extremely talented.
The Jimmy Lunsford band, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And Boyd, you know, didn't have a race policy, except him to say that talent is what counted with him. This was a band that was really about the music. It was a musician's musician band.
And how common was it during those years for there to be an integrated band?
Others were doing it. Gene Krupa, for example, Charlie Barnett, hired black musicians when they could. I don't think anyone really did it to the extent that Boyd did, however. Dizzy Gillespie was with the band. Not only did Dizzy sell Night in Tunisia to Boyd, so Boyd is one of the first people to record that as a V-disc, and Boyd gave it back to Dizzy. He bought it for like $50, and when the thing took off, he gave it back to Dizzy. That this is yours, you know. Which
it
was.
That's such a decent thing to do.
Well, they were friends.
The band did Night in Tunisia, they did, you know, I mean, all kinds of fare that is familiar to music lovers today. I mean, How High the Moon, mm-hmm. you know, Over the Rainbow. But then there are also these wonderful arrangements that the band did. Het Boyds. I do like that.
The attitude of the musicians that played in the band is really important, because it, in a way, these were nonconformists. These were people who were sort of challenging the status quo, not just artistically, but socially. The whole idea of squares, you know, and all of that is intrinsic to where they're coming from.
And like who's hip and who's square? You mean
exactly.
Like that?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what Hep Boys is about, is you know, this band sees itself as hip. And on the inside track and whatever, the humor, you know, Lenny Bruce was a big fan of this band.
Yeah.
And the humor within the band is something that you really have to appreciate in order to learn what the esprit de corps was all about. And it was this sort of amalgam of Yiddish jokes and African-American jokes and all of this around some great music. Hep Boys is a sort of forerunner to the American Bandstand thing. Growing up in the 50s, as I did, I grew up in the rock generation. So rock is a music that speaks to me. And when I see aspects of Boyd's work that resonates in the rock era, I'm sort of proud of that.
Your dad had a song called Tonsillectomy.
It's a George Handy composition. George Handy's father in Brooklyn was a dental surgeon.
Of course he
was. And so this is just a slice of life. I've always loved that song, though, just because of the groove. It's a very smooth groove. Review all the different changes that that band went through, the different personnels, different arrangers. It's a vast spectrum of interesting music, and of course I grew up with it, so it continues to affect me. You know, it's like when I hear my mom sing, I tear up, particularly on something like Temptation. You know, that George Handy arrangement, the way she comes in on that, that's a challenge for a vocalist to come in on that dissonance. Boyd and Ginny used to argue. I heard stories from like bass players on the band bus for the first time, and you know they're getting back on the band bus and they're arguing about who did more for each other's career. And she definitely wanted to lead that band, you know. And it was a tension, but it was a tension based in love.
Now, at what point in your parents' orchestra lives did you appear?
I was born in November 1948, and they were still touring at the time. I did some research for a seminar paper on Boyd and Ginny at Tulane, and found an article where I was cutting my first tooth and they were on the road.
From Hollywood, the most exciting music of today. Played by the most talked about band in the land, Boyd Rayburn and his orchestra.
My governess was like explaining to them what was going on, and apparently, you know, they began having second thoughts about being on the road after that point. My sister was born in December 1950, and by that time they weren't touring anymore. They decided they were just going to work the New York area, playing Paramount Theater and doing like college dates in New York.
And so there you are, you're in the New York area growing up. Are you in the city or are you in the suburbs? Or?
We're in the city.
Okay, you're in the city.
East 20th Street.
Okay, and so what was East 20th Street like according to your earliest memories?
Well, it was glorious. We lived in apartment buildings in what's called Peter Cooper Village, basically for middle-class bourgeois. And I guess, you know, that's kind of where we fit at that point. But after we left in November 1958, right after I turned 10, I did not go back until the mid-80s.
That's a big span of time. Well, where did you go immediately after leaving New York?
Nassau, Bahamas. It was years before I got the backstory. What took us there?
Were your parents on the lam?
In a way. We did get evicted from that apartment. I didn't find out till years later, but Boyd wasn't making any money with the big bands. And it turns out that William Gaines, the founder of Mad Magazine, hired Boyd and Ginny to basically superintend a hotel venture in Nassau right at the time in which Cuba was falling to Castro. Mm. And I think that the idea was that the American tourist trade would divert from Cuba and Havana. But unfortunately, the hotel scheme was not a success. One of the reasons for this being, we moved in November 58. In July 59, while Boyd was in New York on business, Ginny contracted meningitis. And she was misdiagnosed as having tetanus. There was no tetanus serum on the island, just as well, because she didn't have tetanus. She had meningitis. She lasted about 3 days. And so she was 33 when she passed away. And that really sort of just broke up our nuclear family. Boyd came back, began drinking heavily, was incapable of really taking care of me and my sister. And so I ended up with an artist and musician named Don Seiler, because I was going to school with his eldest son. And my sister ended up in Miami with a woman named Jackie Felix, who had like a daytime television program. She was married to the guy that ran PepsiCo for the Southeast and the Caribbean. So, you know, we landed in some good families,
right,
but our family was gone.
That is an extraordinary turn of events.
It was traumatic.
And so how much time passed before you saw your father again?
Well, I would see him periodically. He was living on boats. About every 3 months, he'd have a new fiancé, and we'd go out, get Chinese food, and meet the new fiancé. And then we wouldn't see him for a while. So this really happened a couple years like that. Meantime, my mother's brother, who worked for Capitol Records and lived in Los Angeles, came to Nassau and really felt it was just too unstable an environment for the kids. So Easter of 1962, we moved to Los Angeles, San Fernando Valley, and my sister and I were living with our Uncle Wally and his wife and two children.
And so how old were you then when you moved to California?
I was 13.
Wow. What effect does that have on a boy your age at that time? What did you want?
Well, it didn't often come up. You know, when a child is placed in that situation, it really is about survival and trying to fit the environment. On the other hand, you know, having gratitude that there are adults who are really strangers, even if you're related to them, who are willing to make the effort to take you in. I mean, that's extraordinary when you reflect on it. And so I was extremely fortunate. And after about 4 years' time, Boyd had since married and moved to Lafayette, Louisiana. And he was out of the big band business for good now.
Okay.
And they sent bus tickets for us to come Christmas of 1965. And so we went out there, and I just fell for him all over again. What they didn't tell us was that he had been in a couple of car wrecks and was terminal. So I burned all my bridges in Los Angeles. As soon as I got back, I promised my dad, I'm moving to Lafayette to be with you. And my uncle was not pleased. And ultimately, they retracted their guardianship. So I spent the summer with Boyd, and he passed away in early August of 66. So I was basically stranded in Lafayette. But in reflecting on that, even though that first year after Boyd died, I felt stranded, by the second year's time, I realized how fortunate I was. I got there just in time.
Can I say, believe me, there's no other way. I love you. No use to pretend. There, I've said it again. I've said it. There's nothing to hide. It's better than burning inside. I love you since heaven knows when. There, I've said it again.
That's the Boyd Rayburn Orchestra with There, I've Said It Again. Don Darcy is on vocal. Boyd's son, Bruce Rayburn, is our guest. He stayed in Louisiana as a young man and eventually became curator of the Hogan Jazz Archive at Tulane. Bruce's sister returned to California and became a clinical psychologist. She now works with rock and jazz musicians who battle addiction. Coming up, New Orleans music may be popular, but is it any good? Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're hearing the king of Zydeco, Clifton Chenier, singing Ça m'appelle fou. They call me crazy. Rayburn is our guest. He spent 38 years as curator of the Hogan Jazz Archive at Tulane University. As a young man, Rayburn lived in southwestern Louisiana. That's where he learned to play the drums and turned away from top 40 radio.
The music in Lafayette that comes out of the soil is special. And that feeling, you know, those rhythms, that really affected me. And so by the time I came to New Orleans, to Tulane for a PhD. I had an MA in history from University of Southwestern Louisiana, had been thoroughly co-opted by the cultural historians there, and was sort of ready to explore New Orleans, that's when my jazz education really began. The jazz that I grew up with Boyd and Ginny, big band and whatnot, that's commercial music industry, flavor of the 1930s and 40s, etc. But jazz in New Orleans is something that is grounded in the community and social life. It really is of this place, and it serves, has different meanings, serves different functions for the community here. And so I came away with a completely different understanding of what jazz was all about after spending enough time in New Orleans.
The there's oftentimes a disconnect between how New Orleanians see themselves and their city and their jazz in the overall jazz story, and how others who are not from New Orleans see this place.
So much of the textbook history on jazz origins is written by people who aren't from New Orleans. People that were situated in New York, Paris, and whatnot, who were fascinated with New Orleans and to some extent had an advantageous perspective precisely because they were outsiders and could sort of detach a little bit. I mean, one of the things about New Orleans people in jazz is the diffidence, the way they take it for granted. It's like, well, this is just regular good dance music, nothing special about it. We see that over and over again in oral histories. And the whole idea that jazz is the great American art form has to be imported into New Orleans in the 1940s. But what outsiders don't always get is the full measure of that nexus with community life here, how fundamental that is to the whole concept. And that was the lesson I learned, is that the playing style itself is about this balancing act between the community and the individual, and how you find a middle ground there which makes beauty possible.
You're talking about coming to New Orleans in the early 1970s, right? I'm sure you remember the very celebrated New Yorker jazz critic, Whitney Balliot.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a remarkable story in 1966 called Mecca, Louisiana, I think it was called. He didn't particularly seem as if he was bowled over by the magic of New Orleans music, right? Particularly, you know, New Orleans music as it was being played in the 1960s.
Mecca, Louisiana is a really interesting article to look at. In a way, it's a benchmark because Whitney Balliot was so prominent among jazz critics at the time. And his guide in his trip down here that became the basis for his writing was Dick Allen, who was my mentor. And this is the conflict I'm talking about, which is outside perceptions of art and aesthetics in a kind of formal way come up against this down-home sort of half-fast rhythm that animates the New Orleans lifestyle. And it can come across as mediocre. Critics like Stanley Dance, for example, wrote off everybody who stayed in New Orleans from 1922 on into the 40s as mediocrities, because all the good ones had left, so there was nothing left. Well, what about Jones Collins' Story of Hot A? What about Sam Morgan's Jazz Band? These are bands that do not sound like they're trying to win the aesthetic sweepstakes in Western civilization. These are bands that are groove-oriented and really just want to play for the people to have a good time. Is the easiest thing in the world to get with. It's comfortable. It's like old clothes. They might not always look the best, but they feel good. And it's about feeling. It's about emotion and not these sort of formalistic rules of or aspirations based on, you know, what critics think art is supposed to be. It sounds a little dirty, a little ratty, which is the way we like it. It's an aesthetic unto itself. The only way to really understand it is to get in the second line and let yourself go and dance. What really captures the imagination is that every generation from before Louis Armstrong until the present generates brilliant, genius-level jazz musicians in New Orleans. Guys that are just incredible. Terrence Blanchard, Nick Payton, Leroy Jones, Donald Harrison Jr., Shannon Powell, Johnny Vodakovich, it's just endless. And it's not everyone. It's, only some are special, but they are really special.
While you're learning this music and listening to people who are playing it, at the same time you're absorbing and retaining all of this information. How do you account for having that talent, or is it a gift?
Well, it's hard work. It derives from the training you get as a historian, which is to have a certain respect for factual information, to try to get chronologies right, to understand continuity, and to understand conflict. I think when we talk about jazz history, every guy who played jazz needs to be on the table. We need to look at all of them. And we need to be serious about the context in which we place those individuals. For example, the Neville brothers might sound good at Bimbo's in San Francisco, but they will never sound better there than they do at Tips. But mostly it's the personal experience, the people who really mattered in my life. Post-Katrina, I was sitting in Oakland, California, wondering what I stood to lose. And what dawned on me was what was really important could not be taken away because it was the memories of all the human relationships I had had. And there was nothing material, not even a drum set. It was more people like Clark Vreeland that I had worked with, or Earl King, or James Booker. Having those moments with those people, connecting with them as musicians, that can never be taken away from me.
Every breath you take, oh, every little step you make has all become a part of me. Has all become a part of me. Step you make, my heart can hear me say, each and every day that I love you, baby. I say I love you, honey. I just love, love, love you, baby, every day, every night. I just love you, baby. Love, love you, baby. Love you, baby.
What a great song. That's Earl King singing A Part of Me from his 1981 album, Street Parade. We're talking with Bruce Rayburn, the longtime curator of the Hogan Jazz Archive at Tulane, a world-class repository of New Orleans music. Coming up, A Founding Father Speaks on tape. Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. Oral histories are the most valuable assets to any archive. First-person accounts can offer extraordinary insight into the people and circumstances that changed history. Dick Allen helped found the Hogan Jazz Archive at Tulane when the school received a Ford Foundation grant in the late 1950s. He died in 2007. Allen sought out musicians wherever they were, at bars and clubs, at their homes, at the gas station, even in a hospital laundry. Here's Allen in 1978, talking about oral history interviews for posterity.
I'd say most musicians have an idea of their importance in music, and they have an idea of the value of what they play to the other musicians. They know how they're rated. They're pretty realistic about it, I'd say, on the whole. And some of the most ignorant ones, as far as formal education is concerned, come up with the most meaningful answers. So there are no rules on it.
Allen stressed the importance of researching a musician's life and work before conducting an oral history interview, and he cautioned that a bad question can ruin a good memory.
If somebody says, did you play the clarinet first? Or did you play the clarinet or saxophone first? Those are bad questions, both of them, to me. It'd be much better to say, what was your first musical instrument? Maybe the guy started out on piano. You don't know. And it's so easy to put words in people's mouths.
Bruce Rayburn is our guest. He recently retired after nearly 40 years as curator of the archive. Rayburn remembers meeting Allen in the 1970s when he was a young instructor at Tulane. Allen's attention to detail connected Rayburn to his parents, bandleader Boyd Rayburn and singer Ginny Powell.
Dick Allen was the curator of the Jazz Archive at the time, and so Dick starts pulling out these photos of my dad and then starts pulling out copies of Downbeat with Boyd on the cover, Ginny on the cover. And so this would have been about maybe 1974, 75.
And so you found yourself in this environment in which you're meeting the man who would ultimately become your mentor, Dick Allen.
Yeah. He'd been there since the beginning. The archive was really his idea, but he was not considered to be sufficiently high profile to become the first curator. So they hired Bill Russell, who pretty much everybody in the world of New Orleans jazz studies knew very well. He had done some laudable work on the history of New Orleans jazz. So Dick became his understudy, his number two. Bill Russell and Dick Allen literally interviewed hundreds of men and women who were involved in the first and second generation of creating jazz in New Orleans. And once that reached a kind of critical mass, then other collectors who had sheet music, photography, recorded sound collections. Dick was the guy that really was on top of most of that. The acquisition of the Robichaud band library, it was Buddy Bolden's competition.
John Robichaud?
Yeah, John Robichaud, the violinist. Basically, from the 1890s into the 30s, this is like an incremental chronology of popular songs that are being played for jazz audiences in New Orleans. So that Robichaud library is like a fantastic resource.
Ask you this. I mean, we hear these stories about particular events and we wish that we were there when it happened, you know. And Danny Barker, he himself being a wonderful researcher and musicologist, he tells the story of Freddie Keppard and King Oliver meeting on a street in Storyville, trying to blow each other off the street, and that Oliver prevailed. And I have to say, I really wish if I could go back in a little time machine and be any place, you know what I mean, in history, I would have liked to have been on that street. Are there any moments that you would like to have witnessed first person?
October 1931, Memphis, Tennessee. Louis Armstrong has been forced to return to Memphis after being arrested and locked up with the entire band by the Memphis Police Department, allowed to leave and do the gig in Little Rock, but they had to return and do a free concert.
Why had they been arrested, detained by the Memphis police?
They were on their way from Texas to Arkansas. And Johnny Collins, their manager, had a very nice bus for them. And his wife, who was a white woman, was riding on the bus with all black musicians. And when they go through Memphis, they are stopped by the police and told, this bus is too nice for black people. And you have a white woman with you on this bus. And that was the reason. And they were told they had to get off that bus and get a bus that was ramshackle.
What?
Yep. And Mary Collins says, I'm not getting off this bus. At which point they were arrested in Memphis. And at the conclusion of that concert, Armstrong decides to dedicate a song to the Memphis Police Department. And the song he chooses, and by the way, this is being broadcast on the radio, so there are people at the barbecue in Harlem listening in. And the song he dedicates to the Memphis Chief of Police is, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. And the drummer and Preston Jackson, the trombone player, are looking for the nearest window because they are getting ready to jump out that window.
Tell you what, then. You're the most no-goodest cat I've met in my life. You've been eating up all my red beans and rice, trying to bite me in the back for my wife, you old dog. You wait a minute, I'll come back. I'll show you something. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. Now, I brought you into my home. You wouldn't leave my wife alone. I'll be glad when you're dead. I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal. I'll be tickled to death when you leave this earth, you dog. Man, I took you for my friend, and the way you tried to drink up all my gin. Oh.
About 70% of the rank and file of the Memphis police force at the time were members of the Ku Klux Klan, and the chief of police was a grand wizard. Afterwards, they come up because instead of all hell breaking loose, they come up after the performance, Mr. Armstrong, we are so touched that you would dedicate a song to us. We want to thank you, and at your show tomorrow, the entire police force is going to come with their wives, and we're going to be there in force. Thank you so much. And white hubris would not countenance the possibility that a black man would insult them to their faces. So that, to me, was a heroic moment for Louis Armstrong. I don't think he knew about the Klan membership.
No, maybe not. Think,
but he felt it was time to fight back a little bit, and that was his way of doing it. It was very subtle.
What do you think has been the cost of racism in terms of the work that's done by a jazz archive? Not just Hogan, but all of them, you know, in terms of what is lost forever.
Well, there's an ineluctable challenge, and that is that because the Hogan Jazz Archive is part of Tulane University, and there has been a perception over the years of Tulane as the plantation or whatever, and the fact that segregation, you know, impacted the history of Tulane University. And these issues are still working themselves out. I'm happy to report that under my curatorship, and I saw it before I took over, that people like Danny Barker and Nicholas Payton and others, Michael White, regularly come to the archive and do research, and they are welcome. That's exactly, we want these people here, and yet I have to constantly sort of fight this perception that, oh, the Jazz Archive of Tulane is for white people, you know. And the whole reason we put, or one of the primary reasons we put all that oral history online with the music rising, musical culture of the Gulf South, it's not just so researchers could have access to it, but that the great-grandchildren of Paul Barbaran and Placide Adams and you name it, Jeanette Salon Kimball, we want those people to be in touch with their own heritage. This is something Tulane can give back to the community.
I want to be able to understand how Hogan, how this jazz archive fits in the rubric of the great, you know what I mean, of the great archives around the country and in the world. Is there a pecking order?
The Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University is the biggest and most holistic. They've certainly got the largest record collection. I think they've got the largest periodicals collection, the Harold Flaxer collection, and Library of Congress, Smithsonian also have archives. There used to be one at University of Idaho that got dumped in special collections. There was another one at University of Chicago that got dumped in special collections and lost its sort of core identity as a freestanding research center. When it comes to the U.S., it's primarily Rutgers and Tulane. And we're New Orleans-centric, and they're holistic. And that's an advantage. But I would have to say that in comparison, we've earned our stripes.
What do we got that they ain't got?
Oral history. Our oral history collection, there is nothing like it anywhere else in the world. There are other oral history collections, but we have the most, it's the deepest, and it's with the generations that were there at the beginning. Our people came up as early as the 1860s, as opposed to people who came up in the 30s and 40s.
Incredible. How many would you say you have oral histories total?
Well, various ways of measuring, but I'd say the informant group is between 500 and 600 individuals. It's a lot.
That is a lot.
It's huge.
You are Spokane bound.
I am.
Well, why Spokane?
My wife, who's a professor of Italian at Tulane, born in Seattle but grew up in Spokane. So this is a very nice homecoming for her. We found the perfect house. I have to say, I'm really ready for a new adventure as much as I love New Orleans, and I will be back on occasion.
But let me ask you this. Let's say you're in Spokane. You've got your mug of hot mulled wine, your steps have already been cleared of snow, you've got the record player going, your mind sort of casts back to New Orleans. Are there any mysteries of the jazz story or of New Orleans music that, you know, you're still chasing?
That's a good question, because there are various potential book projects that people have asked me to consider. People have encouraged me to write about my parents. And it's all wrapped up together, you know, because I'm sort of the receptor for all those stories and trying to figure them out, and, you know, which is like trying to figure out life itself, you know. And New Orleans has had such a profound effect on me that, you know, the curiosity really derives from how the negativity and the positive somehow learn to coexist, you know, and because there are tragic elements in every one of these stories, and there are ethereal, really just life-changing, life-affirming, positive elements in every one of these stories. You look at someone like Jelly Roll Morton or Louis Armstrong or any of them, you know, there's such great creativity and yet sadness in every case. And in many cases, the sadness derives from the racial situation, the legacy of slavery in this country. So, you know, I don't think I'm capable of presenting any answers on that, but I will always ponder it.
And so whither the archive?
Well, that's an unknown, and I'm not the guy who gets to decide. But let me say this. Frequently I'm asked when I do my annual file update about my accomplishments in a given year. And the hiring of Lynn Abbott and the hiring of Elena Hebert, I listed on those years as my greatest accomplishments, and it's for true. I have a wonderful staff. I don't think anyone offers better service than we do. I don't think anyone has a more robust web presence than we do in terms of enabling deep research remotely. And we've built something special. And as long as Lynn and Elena are here, that's going to continue, I'm quite sure. We're here to share.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Gwen.
Bruce Rayburn spent nearly 40 years as curator of the Hogan Jazz Archive in New Orleans. We spoke with him at the archive, but now he's a resident of Spokane, Washington. And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Flawn Williams, Garrett Pittman, and Claudine Ebade. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. Special thanks this week go to Elena Hebert and Lynn Abbott of the Hogan Jazz Archive. For more information about Bruce Rayburn, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Rosa Mary Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Studio, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax-deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.